Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. If I take just a quick look at my social media feeds, right now it's wall-to-wall photos of my friends and their friends holding up clever and serious protest signs, mixed in with photos representing news stories covering organized events of resistance throughout the world. The images capture my attention, definitely, but I'm also aware of what I'm missing by just looking at the media. On today's show, I want to zoom in to listen to the voices of people who employ nonviolent and somewhat unconventional methods to protest authoritarian institutions, and in the case of our first story, also celebrate the history and culture of resistance that came before them. In 2016, the cultural arts nonprofit Texas Folklife worked with craftspeople, laborers, and workers in Austin to document the material arts and labor lore of the city. High school and middle school students and teachers picked up microphones and produced a series of stories from their interviews. In this piece, we meet a Hurricane Katrina evacuee who resettled in Texas, but makes sure to take to the streets with his tribe every February.
This is too beautiful for people not to know about. Bring them in. Bring them all around. Bring them all to see it. My name is Jeremiah Williams, a.k.a. Flag Boy Twin of the Shining Star Hunter Mardi Gras Indians.
Every year, thousands of tourists swarm to New Orleans for Mardi Gras. They come for the parties, the culture, the food. But if they're lucky, they'll leave having had a glimpse of something that only a few people ever get to see.
Well, the New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians have been around for over 150 years. And a bunch of people outside of New Orleans never hear about the Mardi Gras Indians. When they hear about Mardi Gras, imagine the image that they get in their head is a float, a bead, a parting. But on the other side of town, there's this big throwdown going on.
New Orleans was Jeremiah's home up until 2005. After Hurricane Katrina, he moved to Texas, but he still travels back several times a year to see his family and join up with his tribe. I met Jeremiah at his home here in Austin.
Hey there.
Hello.
Jeremiah.
Yes, sir. How
hey,
you doing?
Mark.
Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
This must be the place.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
I was struck by the towering feather and bead-adorned suits that filled his living room.
I mean, I'm looking at this amazing, beautiful, intricate red feather suit with all sorts of amazing beadwork. You put in every single one of these beads, huh?
Every single one of these beads. So I start off with imagination of sketching out something on a piece of paper. Once you get that idea on a piece of paper, you transfer that from a piece of paper to the canvas. From the canvas, you put it on a rack, and then you go beading from there. Then I will come back and tie these beads down, two by two.
So, I mean, we're talking thousands of beads.
Exactly.
Two by two.
Exactly.
Like Noah's Ark.
Exactly.
Along with the beads come rhinestones in dizzying patterns, zigzagging and circling the suit. There are almost 30,000 of them.
You know, it's all about being pretty and all about coming out and having the best suit on, so you don't want to half step.
And it's easier if you have someone helping you.
I'm Deanna Williams, the wife of Jeremiah Williams. We've been married for 5 years, together 9 years.
But even with family and a tribe behind you, sometimes it comes down to the wire to get the suit done on time.
Half of the time is the night before Mardi Gras, because you're up there and you're watching him get stuff together and not sleeping, and you're just like, you know what, maybe we're not gonna make it, but the tribe that he comes from, the tribe that he's in, they determine. And they will sit there until the sun come up.
Jeremiah has joined his tribe at every Mardi Gras for over a decade now.
When you put one of these costumes on, you become an entirely different person. It's like a spirit, it's like something come over you, and you become this person that you can't explain. You know, you become this person, you get more strength, you get more power, you get more energy.
That energy is only intensified when the whole tribe comes together to march the streets of New Orleans. And then when two tribes meet, a kind of battle ensues.
So a battle is when two Indians would meet, and you would dance, you would jump up and down, and shake, dance around, and chant your game. I'm the flag boy, I'm the flag boy. I want bow, I don't want them. So you're shaking your sticks, and you each person is dancing, and going backwards and moving their feet. It's all about the feet moving, it's all about the body movement. You're moving your hands, you're moving your own. You're sending signals and all that stuff.
But the Mardi Gras Indians' battles haven't always been so lighthearted. Things were pretty different when the tradition began.
It started out as a protest. People would get together. We weren't allowed to participate, so blacks would get together to enjoy themselves on Mardi Gras time because they weren't allowed to participate in other festivities. So we just went somewhere and started our own thing. And they thought that we was trying to start a riot or something, but we were just enjoying ourselves like the other people enjoyed his festivity. We was trying to start our own festival.
When you look at these suits covered in beads and feathers, you can't help but think of familiar portraits of Native Americans. For Jeremiah, it goes back to when Native tribes sheltered runaway slaves.
Well, just to pay a little bit respect back for what they did for us, we started creating these costumes. Every time I stick myself with a needle or something, I think about the hard times that those people went through and the rough times that they deal with. This is not only to pay respect back to the Native Americans, but this is for the people who fought the battle and paved the way for me to have this opportunity to do this. This used to be a very violent thing. When two tribes used to meet, somebody was going to the hospital.
It just so happens Jeremiah's mentor, the man who taught him to sew, was instrumental in ending that violence.
There was this guy called Larry Bannock, one of the legends of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Indian. He was one of those people that moved it from the conflict, him, and there was a person, the guy from downtown named Tootie Montana, masked for so many years.
Those two and many other dedicated Mardi Gras Indians opened up a dialogue between tribes and brokered a peace. But it wasn't just violence amongst the tribes that threatened the culture.
They would come through with their sirens, flying up and down the street, running people off the street, telling us that we have to get off the street, we're not supposed to be on the street. One of the presidents of the Mardi Gras Indian Council, St. Joseph Night, the year of Hurricane Katrina, he was jumped on by the police. And that was the same year that Tootie Montana went up to that podium and was giving that speech and had that massive heart attack, was saying that this need to stop. This need to come to an end.
Just 2 months before Hurricane Katrina, Big Chief Montana died moments after giving an impassioned speech before a special session of the New Orleans City Council. The session was called in response to alleged police violence and mistreatment. Chief Montana's last words were, "This has got to stop." In 2012, city leaders and the Mardi Gras Indians found a way to make peace.
They all got to the table and had a meeting with the city councils and the police chief and pretty much told them that this has to stop. We bring a lot to the city just as much as tourists and anybody else bring to this city.
Jeremiah says that so far, peace has held. As for violence around the world, Flag Boy Twin has some advice.
The New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians started off as a violent thing. It was a battle every time two tribes would meet. But we were all able to come together and say that this is not working. We're not getting nowhere with this. Nowhere in the world will this beautiful culture will continue to keep going on if we continue to keep doing this. And that's the same thing with what's going on around the world. Nowhere in the world we can get along with each other if we continue to keep going out with violence and thinking that violence will solve problems. Violence is not going to solve problems. Kill them dead with needing grave. That's my violence. And if that's violence, oh well, so be it.
In the end, the countless hours Jeremiah spends on his Mardi Gras Indian suits are nothing compared to those spent on the ongoing struggle in New Orleans and the rest of the country. For Jeremiah, he will continue to pour himself into his suits to pay respect to those that fought for his right to march in freedom.
Creating a Mardi Gras Indian suit is all about imagination. And you take that imagination and have an understanding of the battles that the Native Americans went through, or the battles of that your ancestors went through, and you bring all that together and you create a costume off that kind of imagination.
Even if it keeps you up sewing the entire night before Mardi Gras,
you never finish.
This story was produced by Mark Schoenfeld and Damon Luckett, with assistance from Hannah Wisenet, for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
We have a link to more interviews with laborers and craftspeople from the Stories from Deep in the Heart series at kalw.org. Just search for The Spot. Tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories from indie radio producers and podcasts. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. And now we'll move from a heritage resistance craft that takes skilled hands to a form of protest that takes, well, one finger. The podcast Criminal shares the voices of lawbreakers, lawmakers, and the folks that fit in between, covering crimes big and small. Many of the episodes detail cases that are quite high profile, but every once in a while, they'll also share a story like Robert Ekus's.
So I was driving with my son, and there was a police officer who was traveling the opposite direction as us on the Clackamas Highway, but he was stopped in the left turn signal, and he was going to be turning left. And so as I saw his patrol car, I rolled down the window of my vehicle, and I just stuck my hand out there, gave him the finger, and sped off down the on-ramp.
Why did you give him the finger? Did he was doing anything?
He was driving a cop car.
Who's it?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
This is Robert Ekus. He's a 52-year-old white man, a retired cybersecurity analyst. He's talking about a day in 2007 when he was out with his son in Clackamas County, Oregon. I'll admit, I give people the finger sometimes, but I don't want them to see me doing it. I'd actually prefer they didn't. It's best to do it when you're on the phone. But Robert wanted to make a point, and he made that point very clear. Before he knew it, the police car was following him.
And I told my son, I said, looks like we got a trailer. And he immediately spins around and looks and sees the cop car, who pretty much drafted my ass like it was NASCAR. And I thought that was an aggressive sort of posture. He hadn't lit up his lights yet. My vehicle had a sunroof. So I opened the sunroof and stuck my right hand out the sunroof and gave him the finger again. And he made a high-speed lane change and sped up and went parallel to my vehicle. And I continued to give him the finger, you know, up yours, pal. I'm not going to be intimidated by you, shove it. And so I turned right, and as soon as I turned off the main thoroughfare, he lit up his overhead lights and pulled me over.
You'd think at this point Robert might have backed off a bit, but instead, he rolled his windows all the way up, locked the doors, and then he called 911. So you called 911 on the cops?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did.
I bet that doesn't happen so much.
No, they didn't really know how to take that.
He told the dispatcher that he'd been unlawfully pulled over and that they needed to send a supervisor to the scene. He refused to talk to the officer who pulled him over and who was now standing outside Robert's car, trying to speak with him through a crack in the sunroof.
And I told him, your supervisor's en route. I'll speak to him. In the meantime, I will sit here in my vehicle and wait.
How old is your son?
He was 12 at the time.
And was he just saying, Dad, please, please don't do this?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, this was a sort of stress he wasn't prepared for.
The supervisor showed up, and after an hour and a half of discussion, Robert ended up with two tickets. One for having a tinted cover over his license plate, and another for changing lanes without using his blinker. As you've likely figured out, Robert Ekus has a problem with the police. Not with the individual cops themselves, so much as the institution as a whole. And he protests every chance he gets, always in the exact same way, with his middle finger. I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal.
This isn't the first time I've done this. It's not even the 100th time I've done this. It's just something that I do because I have a generally contemptuous attitude towards law enforcement and the officials who prop up the institutions of our government. And that is a really long political discussion, but I honestly don't know why more people don't do this.
We've been giving each other the finger since ancient Greece. The first documented use of it in the U.S. was in 1886, when a pitcher for the Boston Bean Eaters was photographed giving it to the New York Giants. It's kind of amazing that it's held the same meaning for more than 2,000 years.
It seems like such an arbitrary, ridiculous thing to just pick a finger and you show it to the person. It's a finger. What does it mean? Someone shows me one of their fingers, and I'm supposed to feel bad. Is that the way it's supposed to work?
I think it depends on how you give the finger. You can, you know, just hold your hand out there, you know, flip them off, and that's sort of dismissive. You know, like, you know, you're a jerk off, and here you go. Or you can, you know, shake your hand around while you're doing it, and that's a little bit more aggressive. And indicating that you're angry with them for some reason. Mine was, you know, dismissive slash, what's the word I'm looking for here? Dissension. Dismissive and dissension. There wasn't any anger in what I did.
The middle finger has been at the heart of a surprising number of court cases. Prosecutors have argued that it's disorderly conduct or disturbing the peace, even an obscene gesture. But consistently, courts have found that the finger makes a statement and is a form of speech protected by the First Amendment. Robert was prepared to defend his right to free speech, and he felt that the two tickets he'd gotten that day in 2007 were retaliatory and had nothing to do with the way he was driving. He set out to prove it in traffic court.
If you've ever been to traffic court, you know that your likelihood of winning is somewhere between zero and zero. You know, I mean, almost nobody wins a traffic court case.
He not only cross-examined the officer who pulled him over, but Robert also called his son Brandon as a witness.
He said, yes, my father did, in fact, use his turn indicator. And I showed the judge the license plate cover and pointed out the exception in the law and asked for a dismissal.
He cited a 1995 appellate court decision in Arizona in which a man had been arrested for screaming criticisms of the police at the police. The appellate court ruled that the man was allowed to exercise his freedom of speech, no matter where it was directed.
If, for example, the sole reason that a police officer initiates pursuit of a citizen is because of his taking umbrage to protected speech, then said pursuit is illegal, and anything found in the process of that pursuit is inadmissible. And so based on that, I basically told the judge he had no business, you know, following me anyway, and even if I didn't use my turn indicator, he shouldn't have been there in the first place. So the judge acquitted me on that charge. He actually acquitted me on both. He didn't dismiss like I asked. And you know, being sort of the cocky SOB that I am, there were two sheriffs standing in the lobby, and I just couldn't help myself. So I said to them, I said, you know, that's a win for the good guys. And in case you were wondering, we're the good guys.
We made several calls to the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, but they declined to comment. I wonder, do you see yourself as a bully?
No, I don't think so. I really dislike bullies. And if I had to consider myself a bully, I'm not quite sure how I would, you know, reconcile that.
But I wonder still, you know, sometimes when I don't, this hasn't happened much, but I think that someone's given me the finger before, and I felt really bad about myself. And I've wondered, you know, wait a second, what did I do? Why do they think that about me? Do you ever think about that?
No, I mean, Christ, I've been given the finger so many times I can't even count, and usually what I do is shrug my shoulders and go, okay, I mean, you know, that's the way you feel about it, pal, whatever, you know. Sometimes I know why he gave me the finger, you know, I inadvertently, changed lanes in front of him, and sometimes I don't. I have no idea why he's given me the finger. But in all cases, it's like, okay, whatever, I don't care.
State and federal courts are divided on the extent to which officers should be required to tolerate insults. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit held that critical speech is protected unless it rises above, quote, inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest. Some have argued that police officers have a duty to shrug off insults. They are trained not to react to provocation. On the other hand, when faced with a middle finger case, a judge in Pennsylvania stated, "We think it contrary to public policy to send out a signal to the general public that policemen are fair game for any amount of verbal abuse some may choose to heap upon them." And a judge in North Dakota said, "We don't pay police officers enough to expect them to quash the same human reactions other people have." But for Robert, there's only one kind of police officer exempt from his finger.
We live near a high school. And if I saw a police officer writing somebody a ticket for speeding in the school zone, they were hands off. I wouldn't say anything out the window, or I wouldn't give him the finger. I wouldn't do anything.
But pretty much every other time, his window goes down and his finger goes up. He was pulled over for it again. And this time, the officer claimed it was because the tint on his car windows was too dark.
And I was like, this is complete bullshit. You know, it doesn't make any difference whether my behavior is mature or immature or kind or unkind. It's still my right to do it. And I hadn't actually made a firm decision to sue, but I knew I had the option. And when it came right down to it, as the statute of limitations was expiring, I decided, no, I'm not letting that slide.
In 2010, Robert filed a lawsuit against Clackamas County for violating his right to free speech. His wife begged him not to.
You have to understand, I'm not an attorney. I don't hold any degrees, certificates, diplomas, or anything. I'm just, you know, a regular guy like everybody else who works for a living. And so this is a fairly daunting prospect for me. I mean, there was a lot of reasons for me to say, screw it. You know, I mean, really, I mean, I won the traffic court thing. Isn't that enough? But I decided to take it on, and I started to do some research, and I discovered that, yeah, I think I can win this. So I went ahead and wrote the complaint and filed it with the Federal District of Oregon, and the rest is history.
And so what happened?
Well, they settled.
For money?
Yeah.
How much?
$4,000.
The attorney for Clackamas County told the Oregonian, quote, "We made a business decision. It was cheaper to settle the case than to proceed with litigation." And Robert's not the only person to have received money. Other people have gotten a lot more of it. In 2011, a man in New York was jailed for giving a cop the finger and got $20,000. And a guy in Pittsburgh got $50,000.
If I give a police officer the finger, or if anybody gives a police officer a finger, the police officer has a number of choices of response. They can wave. Hi. They can give you a look of disgust that can only be interpreted as, I don't really care what you think. they can do nothing. Or they could pull you over. But the choice is theirs.
They could give you the finger back.
Sure. They could do that.
Has anyone ever done that to you before?
Yes.
I kind of like that response the best.
I laughed at him when he did it. We were traffic was kind of heavy, and I kind of rolled up along inside of him, rolled down my window, and as I got up alongside him, I said, "Hey," and he turned and looked at me, and I gave him the finger, and he threw his car into gear and sped up to catch me and gives me the finger back and says, "Same to you, buddy." And I just laughed my ass off as I was driving away. The funniest thing I ever saw.
When was the last time you gave a cop the finger?
A few days ago, maybe.
This is ongoing.
Yeah, I still do it. Well, I've been doing it since I was a child.
So this is like your own one-man protest.
Well, no, it's my inability to shut up. It really boils down to that.
We spoke to Robert again a couple of weeks after the interview, and he said he'd been thinking about why I asked if he was a bully. He wanted us to know that he's really not. He said, "I know I'm a man full of idiosyncrasies, but unpopular speech is the most important kind there is." Criminal is produced by Lauren Spohr and me. Audio mix by Rob Byers. Special thanks to Alice Wilder, Henry Gargan, and Russ Henry. Julian Alexander makes original illustrations for each episode of Criminal. You can see them at thisiscriminal.com. Criminal is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Phoebe Judge. This is Criminal.
Radiotopia.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Just look under the Programs tab. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.